Welcome back to The Weekly Papist. We're your hosts, Giovanni Del Piero, Michael Pecca. And today is a very historic day for the podcast because for the first time ever, we have a guest, and not just one, but two, to be discussing the recent events in Afghanistan. So we thought we would take a break from kind of the more theological stuff and focus on this event that's taken place, obviously, in Afghanistan and the repercussions it's had for our country and really just around the world.
Right, definitely. And both speakers will be taking opposite viewpoints on this issue, so we kind of hope to have not really a debate, but more of a moderated discussion. G and I won't be taking part, but we may ask a few questions here and there, maybe to clarify.
Yeah.
You know, if things get a little bit too intense, you know, the passions run high, we'll be there to step in. So why don't we're going to have our speakers introduce themselves, and we'll get this underway.
Yeah.
So why don't we have Andrew introduce himself first.
All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Andrew von Weber-Hansberg. I'm a junior psychology major here, and I have a love-hate relationship with politics, but I still love talking about it. So I'll be taking the position that we should have been in Afghanistan to begin with today.
Okay. Avi?
All right. Hello. My name is Javier Obregon. I'm a freshman, undecided, but probably going to be a politics major, and I'll be taking the opposite position. The American isolationist position that we should have never been in Afghanistan in the first place.
All right. Before we begin, though, I would like to say, especially as this is a Catholic podcast, I would like to encourage people to listen to pray for the people of Afghanistan, because obviously, regardless of what position you take, you know, the Taliban are a brutal regime, and so it's, you know, praying for the people in that country, especially the Christians who are present in the region as well.
Definitely. And so we agreed beforehand that we're going to have Andrew kind of start off. He's making the positive case, so we figured it would be a little bit easier if he was to begin and Javi was to make the case against. So Andrew, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
All right. So with regards to foreign policy, right, certain nations exist on a sort of scale apart or a plane apart from others. So you can make the case that there are several different types of nations. You have superpowers, you have sort of local powers, right? And then you have these sort of like proxy powers, which are generally approximate to like client states of the superpowers, correct? And so the thing about the plane of the superpowers is that there are maybe two, arguably three, with Russia thrown in the mix. And these superpowers, they typically will define their success or their power in opposition to other superpowers. Right, so you can kind of visualize it along a line or some sort of continuum where you have, say, like the U.S. on one side, China on the other side. Any place that has more of one of the superpowers' interest, right, is somewhere that the other superpower is at a disadvantage. They are less powerful because of the presence of that particular superpower. And so any loss of influence in a region where another superpower has an interest is to the advantage of the superpower that does not have as much influence invested in that particular region. That seems fairly reasonable, right? And so, I mean, at least as far as the US goes, if we see ourselves as having a role in the world, and we do, and because of the nature of our structure as a body politic, we can't not consider ourselves as having some sort of role within the world. Our power sort of mandates that we take the role of superpower in the world. And because superpowers do exist and are defined in opposition to the other superpowers, the people, or rather nations, that have the amount of influence that we do, any gain in political influence by one superpower is a threat to another superpower, right? It's a very realpolitik view, I know, but it still makes a certain degree of sense. And I mean, you can also make the case against China, right, that, you know, there are a panoply of, you know, moral injustices, issues with human rights, right? They refuse to recognize the basic humanity of the Uyghur Muslims, correct? They will put them in concentration camps for various reasons. So how does this relate to Afghanistan? Well, the Middle East is the one region in the world which connects most of Eurasia to Africa, and generally provides this sort of like buffer state, even though it's more of a region than a state. But the states within the Middle East are sort of buffers for the great powers surrounding it, right? And so this is a very contentious and very important region of the world. And using the logic of the argument I just presented, any influence of ours that we detract from the region is a further advantage for the superpowers who are defined in opposition to us that would like to invest more heavily in the region. So take, for example, the topic of the discussion today, Afghanistan, right? Our withdrawal from Afghanistan has provided China an opportunity to come in. They have purchased, I don't have figures on like the amount of material that we left behind that they purchased, but they have purchased significant amounts in order to reverse engineer it. And they're leveraging their position in like secret communiques with the Afghan, like, I don't know, provisional government that's been set up.
Yeah.
They're leveraging their position on the UN Security Council to say that the Taliban administration, I guess, they can expand in XYZ particular directions and face no reprisal, at least from China, right? And they'll use their voice on the Security Council to affect a sort of stasis of Western powers. Mm-hmm. And so, due to all of these factors, I believe that we should have stayed in Afghanistan. And not only should have stayed in Afghanistan, but it makes sense for us to be able to project our power across the world and really stay in these different locations and exert our influence within.
Okay.
All right, excellent. So that was Andrew's viewpoint. Okay. So we're going to have Javi. Do we want Javi to like just counteract what Andrew said? What do you guys think? Just
yeah, sure. I think we can do that. Or, you know, you can give your position and maybe offer some criticism.
Yeah, like, maybe like counter and then like offer your own viewpoint or okay. Whatever. However you want to handle this.
And I can ask for clarification, right?
Yes,
of course.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'll go into my position. Obviously, the American isolationist case. I don't think America has any. Well, I guess it didn't have a valid casus belli to enter Afghanistan. I know Andrew might disagree with that.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yes, I understand his point about the important geopolitical, the strategic reason why America should be in Afghanistan if it wants to project global power, if it wants to remain the unipolar, if it wants to keep the world unipolar as in America is the, you know, hyperpower in the world. And it is an important region. I mean, this goes back to Great Britain, right? The Great Game was, you know, whoever controls that area in Eurasia controls the world, basically, right, is what the British believed. And so he is right that it is an important geopolitical area. My concern is that, there is the realpolitik, argument to be made, but I disagree with the whole notion of nation building that the Americans tried in Afghanistan. I think it's a total disaster. It's a total waste of money. It's a total waste of time. If you want to, I'll kind of stick into these terms. If you want to, keep that area under American control, prevent America's major enemies, that is China and Russia, from taking advantage of that position, that strategic location, you could just keep a military force there, an occupied government. But this kind of idea that we have to impose, American values, for example, that's really the crux of my argument, is that the American government, I'll call it the regime, because I really think that's what it is, the American regime, I don't think this government really represents its people at all, especially its right-leaning people, its religious population. I think this regime is, frankly, quite evil in a lot of ways. And I think people that love the American nation will increasingly grow to hate the American empire. We are a nation within an empire, really, I think. People like me, and I think like us in a lot of ways. And so I see the American regime as a force for a lot of evil in the world. The spread of a lot of very evil values, frankly, a lot of destructive, corrosive forces. And so, and I don't think, we have America has a really strong interest to be there other than like the real politics situation, and that is important. But America has a lot of domestic issues right now. a lot of fractures that need to be healed. And so this kind of foreign adventure in Afghanistan is a total waste of time. And so that's kind of the crux of my argument.
All right. Awesome. So I think, Andrew, I know that obviously the American values argument tends, like you said, is sort of the crux of your point. So I want to know, how would you respond to the notion that, yeah, there are maybe some values that if America was to spend an extended time in, say, Afghanistan, they might be transmitted to their people? How would you respond to that charge?
Okay, there's this notion in psychology known as operant conditioning, right? Operant conditioning basically states that if you act in a particular way and your actions yield particular results, that you will add that particular type of behavior will either be reinforced or it will be pruned. And I think this kind of applies to the situation in Afghanistan and our efforts in the Middle East writ large. The issue that we have when we attempt to do any sort of nation building, right, is that the U.S., rather like, say, teenage lovers, has commitment issues. The problem here is that our administration, or our regime, as Javier says, tends to change around very frequently. And when a new regime or new administration enters the world stage, it tends to bring with it a lot of different opinions as to how we are supposed to comport ourselves to the international community. And what this often manifests as is a total reversal of the previous policies that were just enacted. And so you can see our sort of successful attempts at nation building, and you can sort of judge them on their own merit. I'd say after we occupied Japan, after defeating them in World War II, we didn't sort of create them as part of like the American empire, you can say, but we did stick it out. And we invested in their infrastructure and in their industry, their economy. We maintained an occupying force for, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years. We stayed there for quite a while, and now they're a world-scale economy and one of our best allies. Right? The thing is, in the Middle East, we are totally unwilling to put any realistic effort into nation building. We might have the sort of like nation building facade sort of papering over what is generally just kind of conquest, followed by sort of tacit support of the regime in power at the time. But what we're doing isn't actually world building, nation building. What we're doing is conquest and sort of the creation of a proxy state which doesn't really represent our values. And then many people are able to look at examples of these efforts, and they say, this is American imperialism. This is what our attempts at nation building gets us. And to that, I would just say, we have not attempted nation building in those places. And the places that we have generally been very successful.
How are your response?
So actually, I want to jump in here for Andrew. Do you think there's any tension between your ideas that America should remain in Afghanistan and the American inability to nation build in the last 20 years, for instance? Because do you believe that we need to start change? Like, say we stay in Afghanistan, do you think we would need to see some kind of changed foreign policy when it comes to Afghanistan? I know you've mentioned before in our own private discussions that America tends to funnel money into these areas, but doesn't really actually, you know, have any realistic mm-hmm. long-term plans. So if we were going to stay in Afghanistan, what would you like to have seen changed with how we dealt with them as an ally?
Well, okay. I do think that, well, of course, I think we should have stayed, correct? And not only do I think we should have stayed, I think we should have invested probably more money into more significant areas besides just the military, like our military situation in Afghanistan. What we should have done is invested economically. We shouldn't have just given money to the Afghan regime and said, do with it as you please. What we should have done is, at the very least, attached significant like provisos to the money that we're providing. We should have said, you must structure your government in XYZ ways, and you must provide this amount of assistance to this type of population amongst your people. You should guarantee these rights in these particular ways, otherwise we're not going to give you money, right? Personally, I think that would be a far superior way of managing these sort of proxy state type scenarios. But as to your point that if that is unlikely to occur, should we still have stayed? Yes. Because, I mean, even even an orderly withdrawal from a place as important as Afghanistan and as important as the Middle East will cause major regional imbalances and allow the superpowers that define themselves in opposition to our place in the world to gain further influence in those regions.
Excellent. Javier, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, I'd like to respond. So I think you're incorrect in your assertion that there was no real nation-building attempted by the United States. You called it a facade, is what you like a paper over, you said?
I'd say that, yeah, yes.
That's correct? Okay. So I disagree. I think there was an attempt at nation building. It's just that, and your ideas here about like what it actually should have been, I think these are totally unrealistic, because they kind of have this assumption that the Afghani people are, you know, they're operating on the same like framework, I think, that Americans or you could call it you know, people of the West, you know what I mean? The framework that we're on, and I think this is just totally flawed thinking. I mean, like, you know, an Afghani has no, like, the average Afghani is very tribal, number one, right? They don't identify themselves as, like, an Afghani person, as a member of the Afghanistan nation. They have no real concept of this. They have a concept of their tribe, their village, their people, and they're very, you know, ethnically divided. You know, the whole issue with the Pashtuns. I mean, these people are very, like, you know, they're very different to us. They're almost like, you know, many years behind us. And I don't mean that in a condescending or insulting way. I mean that as, like, they just haven't,
just
like...
Just as a matter of fact.
Right. They're just not as... They haven't developed the same consciousness that we have in respect to, like, the idea of the nation state. And so, you know, expecting them to, like, be able to even like comprehend the idea of a democracy, of setting up institutions similar to the West. I mean, it's totally just like, I think it's just totally unrealistic that they'd be able to do that. Especially because they hold a very, you know, a religion, right, Islam, and they're very hardcore practitioners of that religion. I mean, they're Wahhabists, I think that's the term, which is the very hardcore branch of Islam. And so ideas like, you know, Western ideas like, you know, feminism, gay rights, LGBT, even like I saw at the flag in the Kabul, in the embassy, when the helicopter was taking off recently, there was a LGBT flag and a BLM flag next to the American one, right? You know, is that you know, is that what America is? And if so, how can they understand? Like, how do they even comprehend that? You know, like, it's totally foreign to them, and so I don't see any realistic way. And I had a discussion with, I think Charlie told me, you estimated that the time to convert their culture or to you know, be able to nation build was about 80 years, you said, something like that. It would take decades and decades and decades.
I never said that we would convert their culture.
Okay.
I said that we would achieve a degree of, say, material stability that would allow further work within the culture to bear more fruit. And that process would take maybe like 50 to 80 years.
Okay, so...
So my estimates here are fairly conservative.
All right. 50 to 80 years. And so you think that America should be in... You think America should, you know, they should be in Afghanistan for 50 to 80 years. We should remain there that whole time to try to make Afghanistan bear more fruit or be more successful towards more stable. Is that...
Yes.
Okay. I think this is just impractical, honestly. I think a lot of that money should be going to Americans right now, to fixing or attempting to correct a lot of the domestic issues we have. For example, I'd be in support of that money should maybe be going into healthcare for people. I would support a more kind of socialized healthcare system. That's, for example, is just one thing that could be done, I think, to help Americans who are suffering right now. Instead of trying to, I don't know, make Afghanis like create OnlyFans accounts or whatever America wants to do.
Before Andrew, you have a chance to respond, Javi, I want to ask you. So you're, just to clarify, to what extent would you say you are, I guess two questions. Do you call yourself an isolationist? Like, is that do you think that's an acceptable label?
I guess it depends in a lot of ways, because I'm not totally against imperialism. In certain ways, you know, I'm not totally against imperialism, obviously. I think that there are times where imperialism is necessary. But I also kind of, you know, I respect the Afghanis, like, you know, defense of their, you know, sovereignty, I guess you could say. I understand where they're coming from, because if I was an Afghani raised in that culture and land, I would do everything I can against the American Empire, right? I want sovereignty for myself. I want to be able to practice my religion. I don't want foreign interference, whatever. So I think that's what it all boils down to is the, I've talked to you about this, the friend-enemy distinction, right? All politics boils down to this, I think. It's, if I'm going to benefit from imperialism, I'd probably support it. Especially if I think that my people are, you know, we have a right to expand or whatever. But I also understand that, like, people have a right to be against it because they're defending their own or themselves and their people, their culture, their nation, whatever. But in this case, specifically in Afghanistan, and the idea of nation building, I'm an isolationist in this case.
You're an isolationist. Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And can I clarify one more thing?
Sure.
In Japan, for example, your example of Japan, you're right. Obviously, we occupy Japan, and Japan is economically successful right now. But I think, you know, it's not just all roses, I think. There was a lot of loss in Japanese culture, for example. I mean, you can look at it, for example, the demographic situation right now is almost, it's like the West's, right? Or it's like China. It's totally disastrous. You see a lot of their culture, and it's like a total, like, I mean, it's totally, like, you know, been corroded from what they were. And obviously, Japan was very imperialistic and violent, but they also had a very beautiful culture.
They also instructed their citizens to throw themselves against invading forces,
right,
such that the garrison would encompass more than just the soldiers. It would become the population there. And so a lot of these, like, island-hopping things, they would have civilian populations, and the civilian populations would annihilate themselves, essentially, in what were called bonsai charges against the American soldiers, right? So, I mean, like, this was a culture which needed some change. I'm not going to say that we changed it perfectly in every way, and I'm not going to say that the effects that we see today are entirely a result of American intervention, but I am going to say that after the war, which was something which we did not start, what we did to help them build up afterwards left them in a better place materially and ultimately culturally than they would have been if we had not stayed and helped them.
Yeah, I disagree on that, on some of that. I agree with some of it. They were a very, very violent, imperialistic, you know, they did commit a lot of war crimes, just like a lot of people did, and so in that war. And so, you know, I mean, like, to go back to their situation right now, obviously, like I said, their birth rate is, like, horrendous. They have a culture of, like, you know, young men can't even find young women. Like, it's very, where does most of, like, and this might get a little inappropriate, but where does most, like, this hardcore, you know, they call it hentai or pornography come from, right? Obviously, it's a very crude term, I apologize, but where does that come from, right? That's Japan, right? Japan produces this stuff, and, like, they produce all this advanced technology to mimic, like, real relationships or whatever. And so I think you do see kind of, like, this westernization of Japan. And it has produced material wealth, but at what cost, right? I mean, you know, you say Japanese culture should have been changed, right? It had to be changed in some ways, in some respects.
In some respects.
In some respects. From where do you say that? What right do you have if somebody, let's say a Chinese person, they said American culture, in some respects, it needs to be changed, and it's something that you value, that you love about American culture. What would you say to that?
Well, obviously, if it's something that I loved about American culture, I'd be offended, right? But that doesn't necessarily get to the heart of whether or not that thing needs to be changed or doesn't need to be changed. That just reflects my personal opinions on that particular matter.
And isn't it all relative, though?
No.
You don't think so?
No. Okay. There are certain practices within certain cultures which contribute to human flourishing more than others. And I'd say that particular types of behavior, such as, I don't know, ritual scarification, to take a Middle Eastern example, female genital mutilation, things like that, those do not contribute to human well-being or human flourishing in any way. And despite how you might feel about that, these things are cruel practices foisted upon large members of the population by, you could say, administrators or dictators who wield the force of the culture behind them, right? And so these are areas which, like it or not, need to be changed in one way or another, regardless of if we are the one changing them. And I mean, there are cultural movements we can support, right? But that is kind of getting beyond the discussion of whether or not we should have stayed in Afghanistan.
Right, and so let's just bring it back to Afghanistan. So why does America need to be like on the forefront of changing these things? How does that benefit your average American, your average rural working class American, to knowing that, oh, thank God, you know, I might not be able to afford my health care, my daughter might be starting an OnlyFans, you know, my son might be like a transgender or whatever, but at least that Middle Eastern girl isn't getting her like genitals mutilated or whatever. Thank God, right?
Well, it doesn't.
So then, like,
Wait. One second. Having a population of people across the world not be oppressed and playing some part in that doesn't necessarily benefit myself, mm-hmm. but that's not the point of that particular type of action, right? It's to make sure that at least some degree of human rights are upheld in various other parts of the world, right? You can make the case that, and I know everyone somehow loops the Holocaust or some part of Nazi policy into every discussion about politics, but I mean, okay, there's a significant population of Jews in Europe who are being killed, right? I'm across the sea in America. It doesn't harm or benefit me, whatever happens to them, but they should still be protected in one way or another, or we should attempt to intervene.
Right, and I'll just sit.
Yeah, so I just want to hop in here. This is actually a very interesting idea in a recent book I read called Integralism by Thomas Crane. And what he essentially argued was that nations could step in and help peoples, provided that those peoples who require that help directly requested the aid of the country stepping in. And so I think that may be a counterpoint to Andrew's argument with the Holocaust in terms of, you know, the Afghan people who perhaps were oppressed by their current regime, if one they even necessarily noticed it, or if they even would have requested the aid of the American government to step in. So I think perhaps those may be two different issues that we're comparing here.
Yeah, that's,
so I just want you to just address
can
that.
I come in really quick, just say something really quick?
Oh, sure.
So, you know, I don't know if you're making this argument, but America didn't enter World War II to save Jewish people from the Holocaust. They realized that
they didn't.
So yeah, they just came in to preserve the balance of power in Europe. That was the only reason. But go ahead.
Okay, so... the problem here with the notion of a specific population requesting aid, right, is that in many cases, those populations, one, can't really request aid as a unified body. Some parts of them may end up saying, this is not right, what's being done to me is not right, and I protest against it, but they're not going to send some sort of secret communique to the United States in order to say, please help me, please come invade, right? Secondly, in many of these places, these barbaric practices are cultural, right? They have the force of culture behind them. These are people who are raised with the expectation that I am supposed to act in this way and that I will be damned if I do not act in this particular way. And I'm talking about, say, like the women, right, in the Middle East. They're expected to cover themselves, right? In many more radical places, they are just expected to endure what is foisted upon them by the men in their lives, mm-hmm. right? And that expectation doesn't just come from without, it comes from within. It's they expect themselves to act this way. And so what are we to do in a situation like this, right? What are we to do, say, in like a civil case where there's an abusive husband and a wife with Stockholm syndrome? Are we just supposed to refuse to intervene because she's not asking for help? Are we supposed to leave this woman to be abused and like potentially killed, because this has happened in many cases, mm-hmm. Because she, I don't know, wants to stay with her husband because she believes there is still some good in him? No, of course not, right? She's in danger, she's being harmed, we should help her. We have the means to do so. And to Javier's point about money, right, I'd say dysfunctional nature of our various social welfare programs, there's a lot of restructuring that could be done within the administration as to how money is allocated to various things. Our healthcare system is inept in many ways because we attempt to have it both ways, private industry as well as a sort of like socialized system for people who aren't able to have money aren't able to have insurance otherwise. And the problem with that is it drives up the prices in the private insurance market because these insurance companies aren't able to get enough money out of the people who would otherwise be able to afford insurance because they're on the government insurance, right? And so there are different ways to structure these systems that allow money to be used elsewhere in the world, right? And these are places that, or rather, these are initiatives, say, that we can undertake which aim to support human rights worldwide. And to Javier's other point about our impact on the culture of Japan, I'd say that a certain degree of that might have emerged out of our intervention, but it's impossible to draw a direct correlation between our intervention and then the sort of depraved cultural practices of a particular part of any given culture, right? I mean, in developed Western cultures, sure, you have increased rates of suicide in some areas, in some Western cultures. You have, say, like increased use of pornography in some cultures, or some Western cultures as opposed to others. But you can also make the case that that is correlated with the rise of, say, portable computers, and by that I mean phones, right? There are just a variety of confusing factors that don't necessarily all contribute to any sort of cultural degradation. Some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them do a little, some of them do a lot. And I'd say that, I mean, there would likely be some level of cultural degradation within the Japanese culture, whether or not we got involved in building their nation back up at all.
Okay, so I'd like to go ahead.
Before Javi, I'll give you a chance to respond. Before I do, I wanted to pose a more history-related question, because we were touching upon World War II and Japan, and specifically the question of empire and imperialism. Mm-hmm. During the 19th century, the United States was theoretically in a position where they could have taken part in the larger sort of imperial struggles that were going on. There was the question of, should we join the other European imperial powers in, say, for example, the scramble for Africa or the carving up of Asia? And we fought the Spanish-American War. We took some territory. So I want to ask you guys, hypothetically, if you were American citizens during this time period, would you support the idea the United States should have taken a more active role as an imperial power in the world, or would you say, no, we should pull back and restrict more of our power? So Javi, if you want to go first, and then Andrew.
Okay, so at that time, if I was an American citizen, I probably would have supported more intervention in the world. And I say that because, obviously, the government, I think, was a lot better. It wasn't totally evil like it is now. The American regime wasn't in control yet. It hadn't been totally subverted. And so in that case, where I see the government as promoting real American values, you know, healthy values, it was just, you know, a normal, healthy country at that time. And so, yes, I probably would have been in support of imperialistic adventures.
Okay.
Yeah, especially under like Theodore Roosevelt or something like that. Obviously, it's a little later.
Until Andrew approves.
Yeah.
My man, Theo.
I admire a lot of that. See, because, again, like I said, I'm not totally against imperialism, but when I think it's this evil, evil, totally, you know, immoral regime, I have a problem with it. So.
All right. Andrew?
All right. I mean, I'd largely say that I have the same opinion, right? Except for the evil, evil, immoral regime thing. I'd say to that point that when we're in Afghanistan, we're not exporting pornography. We're not exporting, you know, a variety of certain cultural practices to Afghanistan in the way that we were, in a way that we would be if we attempted to stay there and build up their nation further. Because, I mean, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of, like, cultural shedding, right, if you do stay in a place for a certain amount of time. But I believe that the good that can be accomplished in Afghanistan, right, the good which might come at the price of the introduction of some more negative elements of our society, right, is still worth the risks that our intervention poses, right? I mean, sure, there may be a larger portion of the population which uses pornography 3 times a month, but I mean, there will be significantly fewer female genital mutilations. So I mean, I think people of good conscience, would consider that to be worthwhile.
Okay, and so what do you say to the fact that they did this survey of Afghan people? I saw it recently, and I can't pull. I guess I could try to find it on my phone, but about even after 10 years of 20 years of occupation now, about 90-something% are still totally in favor of Sharia law. In favor of Sharia law of the Taliban, they think the Taliban are correct, that they have a right to rule the country. What do you say to that?
Well, I refer to my previous point and say that we didn't attempt to nation build with any degree of commitment.
But the Afghani, shouldn't they want something and change? You know, shouldn't they be asking or something for America to come in? You know,
I mean, where not necessarily, no.
No, so you think that we should just go in if we see there's injustice, just go in and boots on the ground and fix that, you know, make it conform to our values?
It depends on whether or not we're able to support it, but largely, yes. I mean, if the interests of the political landscape that we desire in a global sense, right, align with our ability to promote human rights in different places around the world, then yes, of course.
So you would say we should be intervening if it aligns with our geopolitical interests? If we're able to. So if it's feasible. If it's feasible, then we should be able to.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we only have a certain amount of money, right? Yeah. And we only have a certain amount of money that can be used for foreign affairs. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we don't just have this sort of unlimited budget to pursue our moral agenda across the world. And so the places which should be given priority are the places where our interests in, say, the stability of the region or our interests in opposition to particular superpowers align. Those are the places where we should place more emphasis on intervening. But I'm not opposed to the idea that there are other places in the world which don't necessarily align with our interests quite as heavily that we should attempt to help.
So for Andrew, just a quick question. I'm just going to jump in here. So it seems like our response to Afghanistan was to send soldiers in. Do you think there could have been other ways that we could have addressed Afghanistan without necessarily sending in soldiers, you know, tanks, drones, aircraft? Do you think there are other options that America as a nation could have done to do its, you know, its goals in Afghanistan beyond just sending, you know, Joe from Oklahoma over to fight? I know it's a bit of a cliche argument, but I'm just curious to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, sure. There are other ways. I doubt that they would be quite as effective at accomplishing the goal of like stymieing terrorism in the region as quickly as we did. But there are other ways, right? We could contribute money to the government, specify what it's to be spent on, and then attach, like I was saying earlier, certain provisos saying that you must do X, Y, Z things in order for this money to be sent. Right, and then because their military isn't exactly up to, say, they're not shipshape in Bristol fashion, what we would need to do is probably send like military advisors and attaches. Mm-hmm. And so it would involve, you know, a degree of military investment, but not on the scale that we see now. I just don't believe that would be quite as effective, nor would it accomplish our goals in the region as quickly as we need them to.
Okay, so to the point about the military, I mean, we did have advisors there. I mean, we were training them for 20 years now, or not exactly 20 years, but we've been training them for a long time. We have attachés, is how you say it?
Attachés.
We've been training them, and still a total disaster, right? I mean, just, and the reason why, it's very simple. Why would these people be fighting for this foreign government? You know, you can try to like change them as much as you want, but at the end of the day, what they were doing, they ignored the training, they didn't care, they smoked their what was it, like poppy or opium, opium, right? And they just wanted an easy wage, they just wanted some money that America paid them. But at the end of the day, why would they fight against the Taliban, who they agree with more at the end of the day?
Well, so if I'm able to respond here,
yes.
I disagree entirely, actually. We had military attaches there, sure. But when we withdrew, we didn't just withdraw the attaches, we withdrew the entire support system that their military was based upon. We had created for them a military, and maybe somewhat short-sightedly at that, that relied entirely upon a U.S.-provided infrastructure. And so we withdrew our engineers. We withdrew all technical support. We withdrew many of the tacticians and regional support figures who were there to begin with. And what you end up with is cases of Afghani engineers on Zoom calls with American engineers who are back in the US as they attempt to repair various vehicles in waiting in various cities for the Taliban to come and attack, right? And the thing is, I mean, you can make the case that this particular administration within Afghanistan that they were opposed to our influence. Well, then why did 70,000 soldiers die between, say, I think it was 2013 and 2021? 70,000 soldiers from the Afghan military in their fight against Taliban forces. I mean, they were just as willing to fight as we were, right? I mean, there were women going to school, there were women going to universities who weren't wearing their hijabs, right? People were freer. I mean, from the poor amount of investment that we did there, people enjoyed a generally better quality of life. And now that we've pulled out, I mean, the Taliban has brought down this sort of iron curtain of oppression. You know, women have been taken out of schools. These institutions have been reserved for very few people. I mean, there's this one story. There was an Afghani interpreter who worked with the U.S. military. His ID was burned into his chest on a street. Then his family was killed, and then his 10-year-old daughter was given to one of the Taliban higher-ups for pleasure. I mean, these are people who do not necessarily agree in every way with the Afghani citizens. They're just as willing to kill them over their like tacit support of the U.S. as they are willing to kill U.S. citizens.
Sure, and back to that point, even your point about removing military, the military support system, it was still about 200 to 300,000 in the Afghani National Army, whatever it's called, against 80,000 Taliban. I don't buy this that they removed all the support system and so they couldn't compete. The Taliban are wearing like, they don't even have like armor or anything. They're wielding like AK-47s or whatever and like dingy old trucks. The Afghani National Army should be able to at least hold them off for a while. So I don't buy this idea that because we removed all military equipment or the military support system that now they're suddenly helpless. No, I think it was desertion. It was cowardice. It was a, why are we fighting for this, for the American government? I actually agree with the Taliban more. They're really based. Oh. No, not me. I'm talking in the perspective.
How interesting.
Just to clarify.
From the perspective of the Afghani National Army.
Right, you're saying like at the end of the day, they probably thought, you know, we agree more with the Taliban than we do with the American regime.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Speaking from the perspective of an NAA soldier, I'm saying, why am I fighting these guys? They're based. Okay, and then also to the point about what was it? What was the second point you made about? Okay, the oppressive curtain. Let's not pretend that the American intervention was you know, and the NAA was, you know, all sunshine and roses. I mean, the NAA and the American public government that was there was totally corrupt. I mean, it was totally corrupt. The leaders in the NAA who were, you know, backed by Americans, who were working with Americans, they engaged in a practice called bachabazi. I'm sure you've heard of this, which is the it's a ritual they have in Afghanistan where they basically rape boys, right, little boys. That is a ritual that was widespread by the NAA leadership. They did that. American soldiers were forced to stand outside and just let it happen. They couldn't report it because obviously they can't go against their allies. And the Taliban, it is true that they do forcibly marry young girls. But they did also ban bachabazi. They hang people that do bachabazi. I see something. They hang people from like a stadium. People that were engaged in bachabazi. They will do. You know, they will do the same to young girls. But they did. They did kill. I'm not saying the Taliban are heroes or angels or anything. They're obviously still totally.
But there are certain things that they have.
Right. I'm just trying to illustrate that it's not this black and white. Totally. I mean, the American, you know, sponsored leadership was doing some incredibly depraved things, and Americans turned a blind eye because whatever was practical or whatever, they didn't want to get into any problems between the leadership.
To that, I just kind of refer back to a previous point. I'd say that our nation-building efforts weren't actually really nation-building efforts, right? We consider these people our allies who we're going to invest in and provide military support to, and we allow them their autonomy. And if they're doing things like this, personally, I don't believe that they should be allowed the amount of autonomy that they have that allows them to do these particular depraved actions, right? We were not nation-building. We were providing military assistance to a regime that we were supporting, which is very different. We should have been nation building. We should have restructured their government in a way that does not allow these things, and we should have provided the means with which to prevent these things from happening.
I mean,
again,
there was a restructuring of the government, the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. That wasn't there before, right?
All right, so we're kind of starting to repeat some points. So I think there's a question I want to ask that we probably should have addressed earlier. Mm-hmm. First, what was the reason that America was in the region to begin with, and was that just? I know Javi mentioned a casus belli that was not just for America to enter. I know Andrew kind of gave a look, and so I think it might be good to like discuss why was America in the region in the first place? Was that justified? Do you think we've achieved our end goals from, you know, the initial reasons of being there? And I think that'll be the last thing we discuss before we end the podcast. So just maybe, Angie, if you want to go first.
All right. Okay, so I believe that our casus belli was, in fact, present and accounted for, right? The fact is the Middle East, one, particularly in Afghanistan, exports terrorism around the world such that we were stricken by these terrorist acts on 9/11, correct? And two, the fact is the Middle East is an incredibly unstable body filled with even less stable bodies that compose the region, right? And so the thing is, because this region is so important to the political landscape of Eurasia, and because Eurasia happens to include the other superpower of the world, China, whose interests also align with particular powers in the Middle East gaining, I'd say, an advantage over the other, or perhaps those regimes being in support of China or China supporting those regimes. It's worthwhile that we invest a degree of influence in that region just for the sake of preventing the influence of, say, negative actors around the world. Not to say that the U.S. is tremendously successful at promoting human rights. I mean, we've been discussing this in Afghanistan, and we were not incredibly effective at supporting rights, but that's just because we are we're rather myopic or short-sighted when it comes to these different issues. Again, we have commitment problems.
Okay, so the from my understanding, America's reason for entering Afghanistan, for invading, was Osama bin Laden. Right,
terrorism.
We believe Osama bin Laden. They got the Bush administration. They said Osama bin Laden was hiding in Afghanistan. They contacted the Afghani government, and they were like, "Hand him over." They're like, "We don't have him." And so America was like, "Okay, let's just invade." Right, and it was revealed later that he was in Pakistan the whole time, and that's where he was killed. Right, in Pakistan.
Yeah, that was the Pakistan. They invaded
because the ISI, which is the Central Intelligence Agency, of Pakistan, they are responsible for exporting most of the terrorism. Right, they actually, this is going a little into history. They funded the schools, the madrasas, were responsible for the creation of the Mujahideen, mm-hmm. And obviously they became the Taliban, thanks to American CIA funding and the MI6 and ISI funding. And so, you know, it was, again, my belief is that it wasn't, the Osama bin Laden is in Afghanistan was an excuse. What they were doing was, Afghanistan is obviously an important region. It's right next to Iran, I believe, right? Or it's near Iran, right?
It's near Iran.
Near Syria, I'm pretty sure. Not near Syria, but it's not near Syria, but it provides a kind of foothold in the Middle East,
yes,
to where America can more directly intervene, because America for a long time has wanted to overthrow the regime in Iran, in Syria. We know that they've wanted to overthrow the Syrian regime for a long time,
and certainly,
obviously, I think that's totally flawed, and I have very different opinions on Syria from Andrew. And also,
another episode.
But also, America obviously has a very strong alliance with Israel. And obviously, it's in Israel's interest to be the regional power of the Middle East.
That's another episode as well.
Yeah,
right.
Obviously, that's like two episodes.
Yeah, I'm also very against that relationship. And so, yes, sir. And so, obviously, I think that, you know, getting a foothold in Afghanistan was a way to kind of be able to establish American hegemony over the Middle East, and also establish, you know, secure Israel's safety, because obviously Israel's biggest threat is Iran,
yeah,
and also some other Middle Eastern countries. So that is my belief. It was not valid from like a, you know, casus belli perspective. Obviously, they had a reason to do it. They had a plan established, and I think you agree with this, right? To establish American hegemony in the Middle East to prevent
the enemies. That was my original point when we began this particular part of the discussion.
So that's the casus belli, you would say, that America should be there because we need to secure our interests in the Middle East. And would you say also protect Israel or help Israel?
Okay. Yes.
Right. I just think this is totally Just not
all right, well, multiple conversations.
Multiple conversations spawned from this.
So why don't we have each of you provide a closing statement, and then I think we will wrap up the episode. Yeah. So, Andrew, I go first, and all then right. I'll be.
So, closing statement, you say. Well, I believe firmly that America should, I'd say, support its interests around the world and not just withdraw into itself. This is that particular policy, withdrawing into oneself, is short-sighted in the extreme. Once we surrender our place in the world, we lose the ability to project any degree of influence, any degree of power against those who would use that power less well than we do. And I'm not saying here that we use our power particularly well in certain areas, but there are others who would use it intentionally worse. And so as far as Afghanistan goes, I believe that we should have gone to war with Afghanistan. Perhaps that violence should have spilled out to other particular countries who were maybe more responsible for exporting exporting terrorism. But the idea that we should gain a foothold in this incredibly unstable portion of the world and attempt to provide a degree of stability and degree of support for the allies who do actually stand for particular ideals and who do actually stand for freedom of the individual, say Israel, is a worthwhile endeavor and a worthy goal. And I believe that the manner in which we withdrew from Afghanistan was atrocious in every sense of the word.
Okay.
Javi? So my closing statement, America should never have been involved in the Middle East. It was a mistake. There are more important domestic problems at home that we are facing right now. This country is it's falling apart in a lot of ways, I think. It might not be obvious to us, but I think it's unraveling at the seams. I think that people that love the American nation, that love the American people, they should be more and more suspicious, more and more hostile to the American regime. And I'm not just talking about the Biden administration, I'm talking about really the Uniparty. Trump, I think, is part of the same system, really. I mean, he was a bit of a deviation a little, but at the end of the day, he was subsumed into the system. It goes back to Bush, it goes back to Clinton. I mean, it's been there for a long time. A government that really is hostile to its traditional people, to its historic people. And it goes back to that idea, why do red Americans have to spill their blood for, blue Americans' wars, right? I mean, you think, Joe in rural, Kansas or whatever, you think, he thinks he joins the military because he thinks he's serving his nation. And he dies in some foreign sand, some foreign desert. And for a regime that really, I think, hates him, hates his way of life, hates his religion, honestly. There's a reason they call the Middle Easterners, or a lot of them call America the Great Satan, right? They don't call America the Great Satan because America's Christian or nominally used to be Christian. They call it because they see it as the great exporter of evil, of cultural evil, of degeneracy, moral degeneracy, of, a lot of deprived things. And I would tend to agree in a lot of ways. Obviously I love America, not the regime, obviously. I love the people, I love the culture. I love the landscape. I love everything about it in a lot of ways. But I mean, it's like I said, I think it goes back to this. If you love the nation, you have to hate the empire. That is basically my position.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and cut it off there.
This was, I think, a really well done and thoughtful conversation. Both of you did a terrific job. So I'd like to thank Andrew and Javi for agreeing to come on the podcast. The goal was to make this thought-provoking. I think they achieved that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Lots of points to consider from everyone, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone is not going to have something to think about. So who knows? Maybe some minds will be changed. Mm-hmm. So who knows?
If more foreign policy discussions were like this and represented by people like you, I think we would be in a much better place. So, but anyways, thank you for listening. This has been The Weekly Papist.
And I think our next episode will be next week, right? We still need to do Centesimus Annus at some point.
Yeah, we do. We'll get back on our regular schedule. So this is just to tide you all over until then.
Of course, of course. So. All right, well, thank you guys once again. This is Weekly Papist, signing off.